You're listening to The Retail Perch with Shekhar Raman and Gary Hawkins.
We're going to discuss industry challenges and opportunities in grocery retail, AI, current and upcoming trends, and so much more.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of The Retail Perch. And you know, Gary, like they say, when it comes fast, it comes thick and fast here. The Retail Perch. So this happens to be the second episode we're actually recording today, although you're not going to listen to it back to back. But we're having some fantastic guests. And today, and we were just talking, Gary, about shows coming up. And I guess we're going to meet a whole lot more people coming up here in the next couple of weeks and lots of terrific events coming up. So,
yes.
Yeah, I'm gearing up for that. And I think we mentioned in the last episode, but day is coming closer to Gary's new book being launched, Bionic Retail. I just want to mention it on every episode here until it goes live. It's a great read, and I suggest you get a hold of it. But today we have somebody who is a true legend, a stalwart in this industry. Well, I started off before we started recording telling Phil that he's probably the first person we have on the show that has a Wikipedia page to himself. So that is something. As I had a chance to talk to Phil a couple of weeks ago and instantly felt that he would make a fantastic guest. And I think he's got a ton of knowledge that we can all benefit from. So hi, Phil. Welcome to The Retail Perch.
Thank you, Shekhar. And Gary, congrats on the new book. Can't wait to read it. And every time you write anything, I learn something. So kudos, Gary, and congratulations.
Well, thank you. So Phil, send me your address and I will get a advanced copy out to you.
No, an advanced copy, okay, but I'm still going to go on Amazon because every book on Amazon counts in your rankings, but I will do that.
All right.
Read an advanced copy.
All right. Thank you.
Look at that. But we've spoken like a true supporter. That's fantastic. Not looking for the free stuff, right? So that's good. That's awesome. Phil, so if you can, no pun intended, fill us in on your background. you know, obviously, you've been in the industry a long time. So I'd love to kind of learn your background, how you wound up here, and then we can go from there.
Sure. I could go on for hours, but I'll give you the brief. I was born into the food business. My grandfather's a dairy farmer. My father's a food manufacturer and a food broker. And basically what I decided at that point in time, and I started working for my dad out of college, is that what we needed in the industry was a bit more than just great sales. What we needed was merchandising, design, really understanding the consumer. So went back at night to Pratt to get my master's in package design and started out designing food packaging, because those days it was not only pretty ugly, but basically all the packaging companies would give their design to the company if they would buy their labels or their boxes. So you go in the supermarket, you see, you know, five different brands of peas. Guess what? It's all the same photo because it was free. And that's the way packaging in the food industry worked. That then led to a full service ad agency specializing in food products and supermarkets. That then led to the biweekly paper newsletter called the Lempert Report. And then that led to food trends editor for NBC, doing a syndicated radio show, on and on and on, and to being on The Retail Perch.
Wow. Look at that. The pinnacle of Phil's career is
Retail Perch.
Look at that. That's awesome. That's awesome. So I mean, you've obviously seen the industry go through lots of changes, some of them seminal changes which drastically have changed consumer experience, shaped how the way we shop at supermarket, you know, look at labels, look at packaging and stuff like that. So what are some of the, you'd say, kind of like the highlights of key changes that you've seen over the years that have drastically, you think, changed how we approach supermarket shopping?
Well, I think that the key change, and, you know, I'd love to hear Gary's comment on this as well, is the fact that we've moved away from the retailer being in charge and the consumer packaged goods companies in charge to the consumer being in charge. And I think that's the most important thing that has changed. Certainly, we've got new technologies in the store and so on, but really the approach of a retailer and a brand to listening to the consumer has been significant. We're seeing that evolve through technology more and more. There are some pitfalls, I think, that are on the way, such as all this boon in retail media networks, which I think is going to implode because they're not focused on what the consumer wants. They're focused on getting money from CPG brands versus delivering and empowering information to consumers to make their shopping better. But you know, frankly, I think it's a very exciting time in our industry. I think with the Kroger-Albertsons merger and the FTC challenge to that, I do think, by the way, it will go through. But I think Rodney McMullen is going to have to make two very important concessions. Number one is divesting probably 600 to 800 stores, not just the 431 to CNS Wholesale, and also committing not just verbally, but committing to the fact that prices will remain the same or be lower. Kroger can put out all the press releases they want, saying over the past 20 years, they've reduced prices. But typically, that's what consumers are reading. Consumers are very worried about prices going up. So if McMullen says, okay, guarantee prices will go down or stay the same, because certainly with food inflation, because of climate, labor, you know, everything that we deal with every day, it's not up to the retailer, but manufacturers. But if he will commit to keeping those prices the same because of this merger, I think it'll go through. If those two conditions are not met, I think it fails.
Interesting. Yeah. I was reading something this morning, Gary, about, I think since the pandemic, food prices have generally gone up by 23.2%. Yeah. And I think post-pandemic, they really haven't come down much. I think it's 1.2%. So net, we're still about 20% higher.
They will never come down. They will never come down.
They've come down.
And,
right?
and because of climate change, keep in mind that of the 45,000 SKUs in a supermarket, 99% start in the ground, whether it's a seed, whether it's livestock. The most ultra-processed foods has its derivation from nature. And until we can, if we ever can, harness climate change and floods and droughts and hurricanes and all that, prices are never going to go back down.
We've and got atmospheric rivers that you guys in California seem to have.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's fascinating. So don't you think that the consumer centricity of retail that you're talking about, that's kind of like the new wave, is going to force downward pressure on prices?
They can't. Now, there's certain companies, CPG companies, that have been very opportunistic, as you talk about, especially some of the ultra-processed products, some beverages, some sodas, where they've taken 5, 6, 7, 8 price increases, and listening in on the investor calls for Wall Street, where you've got these CFOs saying, well, we're going to keep the prices high, not because of all those inputs that we've just talked about, like labor, transportation, raw materials, and so on, but because we can. And that's the wrong signal to consumers. And what we saw during the pandemic, and we continue to see, is the move towards more store brands, not only because of value, but the store brands have increased quality substantially. You look at the growth of Aldi. I mean, the reason that Aldi is growing is they're not only a great, efficient retailer, but their store brands are fabulous. They're better than national brands, and they're, you know, 20-25% less.
Yeah.
That's the new model. And these CPG companies who are showing record profits, by the way, their CEOs are getting record bonuses, by the way, as consumers are struggling. you know, that's going to implode on them. You just can't keep on increasing prices. And if we take a look across the pond to what Carrefour CEO is doing, where they're fighting brands and saying, no, we're just not going to take price increases. It goes back to 10, 15 years ago when Denise Morrison had her battle when she was CEO of Campbell's with Walmart. And she said, we're going to increase prices. And Walmart said, no. And she said, well, we've got to. And Walmart basically threw out, you know, I think it was about a third of Campbell Soup products, mainstay brands, because Walmart sees themselves as, you know, being protective of the consumer, the caretaker, the curator for the consumer. And that's what we're seeing. So these retailers, every retailer that I talk to, their buyers and merchandisers are fighting these price increases. But bottom line is, at the checkout, the consumer looks at that, you know, cash register, you know, sign, and they're saying it's the retailer. It's not the retailer. The retailer is still working on 1.5% net, you know, a year. It's the manufacturers that are really being way too opportunistic. And frankly, I think that that's going to hurt them in the long term.
Yeah.
Now, I can tell you one thing, Phil, is that we haven't had a guest on the Retail Perch that has been as emphatic as you about your stance. It's refreshing. Because I think there is no ambiguity here. I think you're very clear about who's getting hurt in the process, right? And I think it's the majority of the population. And there's got to be ways to either through efficiency, better management, you know, to be able to keep prices down. You know, obviously corporate greed is one thing that we all talk about, right? But there's got to be other more responsible ways, especially when an entire population depends on the supermarket for their survival and their food and their nutrition and sustenance. I completely think terrific. Anything to add to that, Gary?
So I think the retailers need to do a much, much better job with telling that story, right? And I agree with everything you've just said, Phil. And I think the retailers have got to do a much, much better job telling that story, because shoppers, to your point, right, they just look at the retailer. It's the retailer's fault. They're to blame. Shoppers have no clue as to the economics of the retail business and, you know, what that looks like. You know, not an easy story to tell, but it's got to be told.
I agree with you. And I think it's a great opportunity for NGA, for FMI to really get out there, because also we're losing consumer confidence, not only because of the price increases, but also because of shrinkflation. You know, when all of a sudden consumers are reading that, you know, Doritos are taking 8 chips less per bag, when Gatorade is now putting a new false bottom to put less ounces in it, cereal boxes downsizing anywhere from 4 to 8 ounces per box, but the price stays the same or goes up. Yep. You know, what we're eroding is consumer confidence in our industry. And, you know, we can, to your point, Shakir, look at corporate greed. That's one thing. They've got to report to their stockholders and give earnings. But the bottom line is, long term, people have to be able to afford their food. They really do. And we can complain all day long about people eating ultra-processed foods, why it's bad for them. The reason that they're consuming ultra-processed foods is that it fills their belly and it's satisfying. They don't wake up in the morning and say, hey, you know, I want to get cancer, have a heart attack, and die an early death. Nobody says that, you know, and people want to inherently eat better. A lot of people can't afford to eat better. Yeah. And I think that the new SNAP regulations that they're trying to put through to force people to only be able to use SNAP on healthier foods is a good first step to that. But the reality is that these companies, you know, can't fool consumers long term. And what we're going to see is we're going to see more consumers shying away from those brands, even if they've been 100-year-old brands that people love. You know, if you cheat me once, I'm gone, whether it's to your competitor or whether it's to a store brand.
Yeah, I think just to follow on to that, the big CPG brands are really, they're hurting themselves here, not even in the long run, right? This is going to happen sooner than I think a lot of people think, that, you know, as prices continue to stay high and continue going up, fewer and fewer people can afford to buy those brands. They're going to Aldi, as you just called out a few minutes ago. They're buying more private label. The brands are going to be doing themselves in this whole process.
Gary, you're right on target. You know, the problem that we've got is, I don't care whether it's the food business or any public company, they think quarter to quarter.
Yes.
What we need to do is we need to look over the next decade. You know, how are we going to feed people? How is our food industry, how is our supermarket industry going to prosper? And, you know, in talking to consumers all the time, what I can tell you is they love supermarkets, they love food, and what they want is they want to be able to walk into a retail experience and enjoy it and talk to Betty the Baker and Bob the Butcher and be enlightened by it and excited by it.
Yes.
And, you know, when we forget about that, that's when those retailers go out of business.
Yep.
And we've seen it time and time again, you know, in our careers, where we've seen retailers like a Pathmark, you know, where Pathmark, these were, and I'm going to come under a lot of criticism and get a lot of calls for this one, because I know a lot of the ShopRite owners, but some of the best, smartest ShopRite owners spun off and they formed Pathmark. And these were really bright, smart operators. And they got caught up in the Wall Street issue, and Pathmark doesn't exist anymore. And it was one of the best retailers in the country.
Yeah, yeah. So the other point I want to circle back to you made that I think is really important to call out is, you know, what the government is doing, trying to help support people buying more nutritious foods and so on, right? And trying to guide SNAP dollars, other benefit dollars to only certain foods or more nutritious foods. I think that's it's a great idea. It's a great thing to do. I think the problems are coming in the implementation of that, right? Who defines what's healthy, what's nutritious, what's not? You know, we've seen, you've certainly seen a lot of this, you know, the big food lobbies influencing, you know, what the FDA comes out and promotes is, you know, healthy eating or, you know, the whatever the latest.
Food is medicine.
Yes. Yeah. Well, food is medicine and, you know, the whole here's what you should be eating and how much of certain food.
And all that, right?
And so on. Yeah. You know, you don't have to look too far, look at that and say, oh, gee, this really doesn't make a lot of sense, you know, and so the lobbyists steering this in a not a good direction.
Gary, you're 1,000% correct. And keep in mind that we also have to take into concern consumer behavior. There was a study, I believe it was up at Harvard or University of Massachusetts. Some researcher about a year and a half ago, did a study of people who were on SNAP trying to get them to eat healthier. And what they found is it took something like, and I'll get the number wrong, but something like 11 times for one of these consumers to be able to switch behavior to healthier eating. So instead of having, you know, chips as a snack, having them have an apple. So it took 9 to 11 times. This population can't afford to throw away the apple 9 or 11 times till their kid starts eating it. So that's one problem that we've got. And to your point, defining healthy. And I bring up food as medicine because while I think the concept is right, I think what's happening is wrong. So food is medicine, and I applaud all these retailers who have signed into the White House initiative. Most of Food is Medicine Initiative is about hunger. It's about getting food to people, feeding people. It is not, that's not food as medicine.
Right.
Food as medicine is what our retail dietitians have been doing for 20, 25 years in educating and empowering people. So what I'd really like to see is the White House and our industry separate that out. Food as medicine is one thing. Hunger is another whole thing.
Yep.
And they're both equally as important. In fact, probably hunger is even more important. But we need the tools to empower people on how to eat healthy and to understand their behavior. And to your point, Gary, understanding that the committees that are formed and so on with all these lobbyists, they want to make sure that, you know, their food is on that healthy list, even
right.
if it doesn't qualify. We've got to get past that. If in
yes.
fact we want to change the behavior, if in fact we want to reduce obesity, heart disease, cancer, we've got to get past all that. And let's not forget with the GLP-1 medications, whether it's Wegovy, Ozempic, Mounjaro, and so on, that's changing behavior. And while we only have about 10 million people being prescribed it now, guess what? There's another 15 million people that are getting the generic versions of it. 25 million people. New England Consulting is predicting that that's going to over double by the year 2030. So with people on these weight loss medications, and we don't know the long-term effects, and I'm not endorsing it or not, but I'm just saying consumer behavior is going to change. We need
yes.
smaller
yeah.
portions. We need, you know, to really fulfill what they need to be healthy, because we know if we can drop obesity by 20, 30, 40, 50%, that improves our healthcare system. It improves
yeah.
everything, as well as people's lives.
Yeah. And it seems like, you know, from what you're saying, food accessibility and food, healthy food have to be aligned, right?
Yes.
Accessible food has to be
yes.
made healthy. If
yes.
you have that mandate, as opposed to accessible food is any food that's going to fill your stomach, you
correct.
Know, then you're creating two problems. You know, one is by making food accessible, you're actually increasing the, lowering the health of the population because you're mostly giving them access to, you know, bad food.
Yep.
And then, you know, healthy food then becomes a luxury for a lot of people, and you're going to, you know, marginalize a lot of people who have access to it.
And healthy food should not be a luxury.
Exactly.
And,
right.
and, you know, when I talk to consumers and even people in the industry, and they talk about how healthy food is more expensive, it's not more expensive. You know, you go to the produce department, you can fill your belly with really good, nutritious fruits and
right.
vegetables that are not expensive. Have instead of an 8-ounce steak, have a 4-ounce steak or a 4-ounce piece of chicken. Have seafood. Seafood is one of the most underrated healthy proteins that there are. And the reason is that people are afraid of, because they don't know how to cook it.
Right.
And, you know, maybe if they cook it wrong, it smells up their kitchen. Well, let's educate people to what foods, whether they be fresh or frozen, are good proteins, what the right portion size is, and fill up the rest of the plate with vegetables. We've been saying this for 30 years, 35 years, and we still haven't gotten the message through to consumers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So where do you think the opportunity lies here for somebody who's maybe listening to this as a solution provider and like, hey, how do we help this industry? I mean, apart from the government initiatives that have to happen and the CPGs having to do this, what do you think, where do you think the role of entrepreneurs is in this whole thing?
Well, first step is read Gary's new book, number one. Number two is get into stores. I visit between 10 and 15 stores each and every week. And I walk up and down the aisles and I talk to consumers and I look at what's going on. We can't build a better retail experience by sitting behind a desk. We need to be in the stores. I'll never forget this. Pre-pandemic, there was a new Hy-Vee that opened up. I was walking the store with Randy Edeker and a whole bunch of his people. and we were talking about cage-free eggs, because at that point, that was in the headlines. And Randy said something to me very important. Every retailer, every food company was committing to 100% cage-free eggs. He did not. And the reason he didn't is he said, cage-free eggs are going to increase the price for my SNAP customers by a couple bucks a dozen. And these eggs are their primary source of protein. If I increase the price of eggs and go only cage-free eggs, I'm going to damage the health and well-being of my customers. I should be able to offer them both. He was one of the few people to say that. And when we look at the reality of cage-free eggs, it's BS anyway, because cage-free eggs means that a chicken can turn around in the space of a foot. These are not happy-go-lucky chickens running around outside. So it's a big boondoggle to begin with. But that's what we need. We need retailers like that that are going to be focused on consumers. And the way you get that is in the store, really looking at consumers. This goes back probably 20, 25 years ago. I was in a store and I saw a woman who was probably in her 60s, 70s. This was a ShopRite in Lincoln Park, New Jersey, Larry Wolfson's store. And she was at the olive oil section and looking at different bottles and so on. And I said to her, because I'm one of those kind of pain in the neck people that get thrown out of supermarkets, can I help you? You know, you seem to be confused. And she said, I am so confused. There's 100 different bottles of olive oil in front of me. And my husband was just diagnosed with a heart condition and high cholesterol. And the doctor said, you know, I should be cooking in olive oil. But I look at extra virgin, this, that, these different brands. I just don't know what to choose. Can you help me? So I said, okay, let's start with, you know, how you cook. You know, what kind of oil are you using now? And she said, I'm not using oil. I bake everything. I bake my fish. I bake my chicken and so on. So here's a doctor who says switch to olive oil. And this consumer isn't even using olive oil, isn't using any kind of oil.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the kind of issues that we have to deal with. And we're only going to learn from talking to consumers if, in fact, we're going to break through, build a better retail experience, empower consumers to eat healthier or not. I mean, everybody doesn't have to eat healthy. People can indulge all they want as long as they're aware of what they're eating, as long as they're looking at ingredients and nutritional information, and unfortunately now net weight, and being able to look at all of those to make good decisions, then we've accomplished something as an industry.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think that, you know, more people are understanding the role of food in their health and long-term health, and are paying more attention to that. There are certainly a growing number of tools out there in the market, you know, technologies, apps, et cetera, shoppers can use to help understand what's gluten-free or what's high in fat or whatever that I should avoid. But that's got to continue, and there's got to be a lot more of it.
And we, as an industry, have to be smarter and better. And I'll bring up 2 points. Number one, if I go on most supermarket retailers' websites and I type in peanut-free chocolate, one of the first things that come up is Reese's Peanut Butter Cups.
Yeah.
So our data in these databases for products are lousy at best. They're probably about 50% accurate from all the retailers that I've spoken to. So we've got to clean up our act there. The second one is I happen to be on the advisory board of FAIR, the Food Allergy Group. And one of the things that we're trying to do is get away from this nonsense that labeling on packaging say may contain peanuts, you know, manufactured in a factory, in a facility that has soy and whatever else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That doesn't help somebody that has a food allergy, and over 33 million people have food allergies. This is a pretty big market, and it's influenced by about 100 million people who are in the same family. So we have 100 million people that need accurate information, and saying may be made in something or may have peanuts in it doesn't help them. It excludes, you know, thousands of products that these people can be consuming. So right. As an industry, we've got to be more accurate with our ingredients, more accurate with our sourcing material, and just be more transparent to the consumer. Let them have a wide array of choices, but it's got to start with good data. Bad yes. data gives you bad information.
Yeah, we know that pretty well. Yeah. So I think, you know, data standards in the retail industry, especially the supermarket industry, aren't anything to be writing home about, right? So lots exactly. of cleanup to be done there. Yeah.
Yes.
So from a, well, this is all fascinating because I think I can see your passion here, Phil, about essentially the supermarket industry being such a key part of people's lives. It has to be something that is a force of good to enhance people's lives. And you need people with a deep sense of commitment to improving society to be running it. I think for a lot of people, they think that running, you know, a good, honest business that's good for society doesn't necessarily make money. And I don't think that's true.
Sure.
I think there's this contradiction that a lot of people have that if I'm running something that's good for people and it's truly beneficial, somehow I can't make money at it. And I find that people are willing to pay more voluntarily for people who are more honest and provide a cleaner and better service than otherwise. And I think that has to change. So one of the things we were talking about in previous episodes was about, you know, education, right? I mean, part of what has to happen here is consumers, I feel, I know your background is in the packaging industry, and a lot of packaging today, unfortunately, is fairly misleading for a lot of customers. And it's very difficult to figure out, is this good for me, not good for me? Because, you know, something, you know, fat-free seems like, is that supposed to be good? You know, sugar-free, is that supposed to be good? Because I think people have kind of equated these terms with healthy foods, right? And part of it is because of messaging, you know, how messaging has gone out. And it's kind of been drummed into people's heads that, hey, something that's low-calorie means it's healthy for you, right?
Right.
It's okay, it's full of preservatives, but it's low calorie, right? So how is that? Do you think that's a industry governmental change? Who has to make that shift? Because ultimately, if the consumer has to be educated, information has to be easy to consume to make a decision on, right? You can't be leaving them with you need a PhD to figure out what's in this product.
You are 1,000% correct. And probably, you know, the go-to example for me is always Snackwells from Nabisco, going back decades. So Snackwells, I think they got up to, and Gary might have a better number than I, but I think they got up to about 70 SKUs. And Snackwells was fat-free. And yep. they had commercials of consumers running after Snackwells trucks, you know, in the street. To consume all these cookies and crackers and other things that were fat-free. And in the meantime, people were gaining weight. And the reason is that they loaded it up with sugar, bulking yeah. agent. You needed something so that that cookie would have some substance. You are 1,000% correct. What we need is, and I hope it's not governmental, but we need the industry to stand up, and just the same way that they're doing with fighting prices from CPG companies, having standards. And I do see it on sustainability. you know, Whole Foods started it with sustainability of seafood and meats and so on. But the more buyers and category managers that I speak to these days, more of them are holding these CPG companies' feet to the fire, that they're not accepting products that have a ton of preservatives in them, that they're not just accepting the claims on the front of the package. They're saying, I want proof of this. You're coming to me saying XYZ, show me how it's real, prove it to me. You know, what we saw during the pandemic is, you know, the rise of hand sanitizers. A lot of retailers stocked a lot of hand sanitizers that were nonsense, that didn't do anything, that didn't meet, you know, the criteria to actually killing bacteria. Well, and a lot of consumers spent tens of millions of dollars on hand sanitizers. What we need is the retailer to stand up and be that curator and ask for the proof of it. You know, if the government gets involved, back to Gary's point before, between lobbyists and, you know, political interests and all this other stuff, we achieve nothing.
True.
It starts and ends with the retailer. If you've got a retailer who cares about their shoppers, who cares about delivering value, quality, you know, every retail store doesn't have to have every retail product in existence. Right, you know, if I look at Oreos, to pick on Nabisco again, you know, I think they got up to about 25 different SKUs of Oreos, you know, small Oreos, big Oreos, double stuff Oreos, pink Oreos. Hello. I mean, back to Aldi. Aldi has proven that we don't need 100 different varieties of olive oil. They've got four. They've got a general purpose olive oil, a high-end imported olive oil, an organic olive oil, and an extra virgin olive oil. And guess what? Aldi customers are very, very satisfied with those four olive oils. We don't need all this. And the way the brand managers succeed and get a bigger brand is line extensions.
Yes.
So I've got an Oreo. Let me do two more Oreos. Hey, I get a promotion. Now I get a bigger brand. The whole system is wrong.
Yeah.
Let's satisfy consumer needs. Let's have products that meet those needs for both the retailer and the consumer and the manufacturer. I want them to make money. I want the Oreos to make money. Do I consume Oreos? Not often, but I want them to make money. But we don't have to have all these excess marketing dollars, all this nonsense taking place that takes away from the joy of food, of the nutrition of food, of the empowerment of food. And the retailer is the one who can control that. Not you, not Gary, not me, definitely not the government.
Yeah.
But the retailer can do it. And those retailers who want to do it, in the early days of Whole Foods, you know, they did it. And there's other retailers that are out there like Sprouts and so on. They've got very, very tight constraints of the products that they will put on the shelves. That's right. Good. And as a reward for that, they've got a very loyal consumer base because they know that the retailer is watching out for them.
Yeah. And, you know, it shouldn't take some complicated AI and an app for you to figure out if this food is good for you, right?
No, it shouldn't.
It should be a lot simpler than that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, I think, you're right. We could go on for a whole week.
Well, we just have to do it again.
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah. You have to be in like our regular, you know, every quarter episode. Got to have Phil on. But this is unbelievable because I think, you know, we talk about, you know, Phil, on this show, we get pretty excited about technology and data and, you know, all the cool things coming on and, you know, all that's exciting. But I think, you know, and losing focus of the basic purpose of this supermarket, what is it looking to satisfy? And if you're not meeting those basic objectives, then solving all the other problems seem superfluous compared to solving this basic need, right, of what a supermarket means to us.
The technology is the tool to make all that happen. I love technology. I love what we're doing with supermarket and technology, but it's not the technology that we're selling. We're selling food. So how do we use that technology to enhance that customer experience? If we do that right, we win. If we just put in tech, I remember, and Gary probably remembers, when Food Lion came out with Bloom.
Yep.
The Bloom store was fabulous. But what they did is they bought every technology imaginable and threw it in the store. I mean,
that's right.
They had every technology imaginable in that store. And the store failed because it wasn't technology to help the consumer. It was technology to be able to say, we're buying technology.
It was tech for tech's sake instead of tech to solve a problem.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Gary, I don't even know how to conclude this episode. It's like difficult.
It's easy.
I don't want to. That's what it is.
All that we've got to do is we've got to say that all of us in the industry have to spend more time in stores. We've got to talk to more consumers. We've got to talk to more store managers and find out what their problems are, how we can help them. We've got to be in store. We've got to be in consumers, and we've got to be in food.
So I agree with that. And I think I would add to that by saying everyone in the industry has got to be focused on the shopper, especially everybody in the supermarket industry, right? At retail, has got to be focused on that customer, because far too often the incentives are not aligned with the customer, right? The category manager is rewarded on how many cases of Pringles can I sell,
right,
not on can I get a healthier product on the shelf and improve, you know, the well-being of my shopper.
And it just doesn't have to be about health. It can be, you know, ethnic foods that are very exciting, that consumers are looking for, you know, new cuisines all the time, and it's recipes. Health is just one of the pillars of this, and price is another one. Convenience is another one, and indulgent. Hey, look, I love, you know, having a really indulgent scoop of ice cream. Do I have it three times a day? No. But, you know, I want that available. And a supermarket has to offer everything to everybody. If it's just a health food store, it goes out of business. Whole Foods found that out. They had to expand what they offered as well.
Yeah.
You know, we need to be able to offer to every consumer, no matter where they are, what they're looking for. You know, I was just talking to Gonzales Markets, and they opened up a new fabulous store. And one thing that I didn't know, even though that it's a Hispanic-focused chain, what they appeal to is not just Hispanics. What they find is they have got a huge Asian and Indian population who goes to their Hispanic stores because they've got more flavorful foods.
Yes.
So I was sitting there saying, oh, yeah, Anglos who want, you know, better, more flavorful foods and so on. I said, no, our market is Hispanics, Asian, and Indians. That's
I've been to those stores. They have an amazing guac station, and you know, I mean, their in-store food, hot foods, fantastic.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. And you're kind of transported. They really do that experience. You walk in, you feel like you're in Mexico. You feel they've kind of created that ambiance. Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's a great example.
And you want to be there.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the key for smart retailers, creating an environment and an assortment and service for somebody who feels comfortable and wants to be in that store. If you have a supermarket that nobody wants to be in, you're going to go out of business.
Yeah. Real fast.
Yeah, real fast. Exactly. So Phil, as we draw this to a close, and my God, this has been such a fantastic conversation. My head's spinning right now because I'm like, we need to get you back on quickly because I can't not talk to you soon enough, right? But if you had to kind of leave a message here for retailers and say, hey, you know, this is something to get them thinking, really, what should they in 2024? It's a new year. It's great opportunities. I think technology is at really people's fingertips. I think we have access to technology that we've never had before. What would you implore them to do as, you know, here's what you should be really top of mind for you in 24?
I'm going to steal this from Gary's comment. Don't buy technology to buy technology. Buy technology that helps the consumer. We're seeing now lots of new technologies, from intelligent shelf strips to mobile apps and so on, that do all this. But it has to be for the benefit of the shopper. There's a lot of technology in the back room that retailers need to be able to understand consumer needs. Yes. And technology is moving so quickly with AI, with chatbots, with all this stuff. It's fabulous. But understand, it's there for one reason, and that's to make that shopper a better shopper. So as long as you keep that top of mind, and yeah, we're focused on Kroger, Albertsons, we're focused on, you know, micro fulfillment centers and all that other stuff, but it comes down to the shopper.
Yeah.
If there's not a benefit to the shopper, who cares?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, on that note, Gary, any concluding remarks?
No, I think it's a good message to close this episode out on.
Yeah, I love it. Absolutely love it. Phil, we got to get you back. By the way, you sent us your address in Santa Monica. We'll send you one of these, a coffee mug.
Right?
A Retail Perch coffee mug. I'll carry one extra with me just in case I run into you. I can pass it over to you.
But
if you can send us your address, that'll be even better. We'll mail one out.
And this mug that I use every day, this is actually the mug that was given to me by, so I love mugs, so I will take it. This mug was given to me by Gene Natick, who was the founder of Weight Watchers many, many years ago. At one of the first Weight Watchers meetings that she had for the press. So I still have it. So it's time for a new mug. So
awesome. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But listen, thank you so much. This was just fantastic. What a treat it was. And I'm sure listeners are going to absolutely love this. Gary, anything else before we close out?
Phil, thanks. It was great to see you and talk with you again. And
yes.
We'll look forward to connecting again here real soon.
I know. And well, we get excited to talk to guests. I know this each episode is put together by a team of people who go and edit and take out all the ahs and ums and make it nice, look nice and smooth. So I want to definitely give a big shout out to all these people behind the Retail Perch. And again, you know, it doesn't happen without guests like the amazing Phil Lempert. So look forward to talking to you again soon, Phil.
Yes.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Make sure to join us every Monday and connect with us at The Retail Perch on Instagram and Facebook.
And if you have any questions, feel free to email us at theretailperch@birdseye.com.
Until next time, this is Shaker.
And this is Gary, signing off.